What do Bing Crosby, the Andrews sisters, Keith Richards, and Eric Clapton have in common? Their lives have forever been woven together with the masterful fingerwork of the original guitar hero, Les Paul. My name is Maggie LaPique, and in April of 2008, I traveled to New York City to sit down with Les Paul and speak with this legendary guitar player and electronic innovator. But first, let's listen to this early Les Paul recording with blues singer Georgia White in 1936. We hear Les's emerging talent at just 21 years of age.
He left me fizz and bought a newspaper to see.
I met Les Paul inside a very small room in the back of the famous Iridium Jazz Club, located at 51st and Broadway, in the heart of Manhattan. Les has been playing two shows at the Iridium every Monday night for the last 14 years to consistently sold-out crowds. On a chilly Monday afternoon before his first set, Les Paul was in great form. Tell us some of the wildest ideas you've ever had.
Wilder. I'm not going to tell you that on TV or radio.
It's the Les Paul Show.
The wildest ideas I had, I guess, they were all wild in those days, each one of them. Were extremely eccentric, different. Nobody else in the block was doing it, and so consequently, whatever I did, including my own people in my own home, thought I was a little off center.
My invention, the Les Pulverizer. That's a gadget I invented. I've been using it on the show here. By plugging my electric guitar into it, it makes it multiplies it until I have a full orchestra of guitars.
In creating sounds that have never been heard of before, that's something to get used to right there. And if it's something that's pleasant, and it's a pleasant surprise, and it's what you would like to hear too also, then that even makes it more in your favor. Whereas if it was a terrible sound that you made, then your dreams wouldn't be too good.
Your first instrument was harmonica, and you were 8 years old. How did the harmonica come into your life, and why?
Well, a harmonica was a way of playing different songs. And the first thing that I got a hang of was the fact that you could take this harmonica and you could bend notes and you could do things with it that normally wouldn't be heard on the harmonica. Or was a rarity to hear some of the things that could be done with a harmonica by modifying the harmonica, which of course I did right away. The sewer digger that I stared this harmonica out of on the lunch hour, he finally says, "I think you want this more than I do," and he handed it to me. But a hand came in between us, and it was my mother, and she says, "You don't play this until I boil it." Okay, so she boiled the harmonica, and I've been boiling guitars ever since.
This is fun, and I knew it would be. Now, you were heavily influenced by Django Reinhardt, and what was it about Django's playing that captivated you?
Well, first of all, that he was a very good player, and secondly, I was really inspired by Eddie Lang first. That's where I did most of my learning, along with a private friend of mine. His name was Joe Wolverton. He had studied the guitar correctly, and so I learned correctly how to play the instrument, what the instrument was all about, and how it should be played so that you know your instrument. And then along came Django Reinhardt, which was an excellent player. And, of course, he's someone like any great guitar player. You admire him for what he did. And he did some very good things on the acoustical guitar, not so much on the electric as the acoustical. And we were sort of competitive. We went different directions, but both are on the same instrument, so to speak. It's a fretted six-string guitar and a pick, and it's up to what you do with it and what you have to say when you got it in your hands. When you got it in your hands, it's a matter of if you want to bang a note out or you want to caress that note. And the other is how you prefer to have that note played that makes it different than somebody else. In other words, you can play it on the same guitar, play the same note, but two different players can sound entirely different.
I agree, and that's what gives people their sound or their uniqueness. Before settling, in as a guitar player, you also studied piano, and I've read and heard that you were influenced by Art Tatum.
They're doing a special event at the Apollo in Harlem, and they're donating his original piano that he learned on. And Art Tatum and I were very good friends way back in Chicago before I joined Fred Waring in New York and before we went to California. Art and I were very good friends. And the more I knew him, the more I knew I'd never be a piano player after hearing him play the piano. He was the piano player of piano players. so he's badly missed, and probably no one for a long time is going to beat him. And so it was an extreme privilege to know a person that talented.
Yes, Art, there'll never be another you. It could have been written for Art Tatum. But I wanted to ask you about being in Chicago in the 1930s, and you were on the radio doing a hillbilly act, and as Rhubarb Red, and playing jazz as Les Paul. So how did that dual persona come about?
Well, it came about first when I first built my crystal set, and I heard the music, and I shared it with my mother. My mother was just an inherent hillbilly. She loved country music. She could understand country music. She knew that it was a very commercial type of music. And so I must say that she did encourage me to be a country hillbilly, a bluegrass picker. And as I grew older, as I grew older, that would be correct, I had two ideas in mind. And one is, over here is some music that's very progressive and very well thought out. The country music was more simple music, and, well, it just was an entirely different country music that was sort of separated from jazz or pop music. As I progressed, I had two types of music, and one I decided would be in the daytime, and that would be Rhubarb Red, and at nighttime I would be Les Paul, and Les Paul would play nothing like Rhubarb Red. They're two different people playing two different kinds of music.
Was there ever any conflict between the audience that loved?
Only with Art Tatum. Art Tatum said to me about 4:45, he says, "I suppose you're leaving us." And I says, "Yeah, I got to go to work." And so Art turned around and said to the Roy Eldridge, he says, "Where in the world is a guy to go to work when we're going to bed?" And he says, "Well, you know, he's really two fellows. He's Rhubarb Red in the daytime, and he does country music, and at night he plays with us here, and he plays jazz at the Three Deuces." Well, this really surprised Art. So Art says, "I want to listen to this guy." And so he listened to me do the country bluegrass music, and he was not only entertained by it, but and surprised by it, but every once in a while I'd let go with a jazz run in the middle of the bluegrass music, which, by the way, today is becoming very popular. And my next album is going to be a bluegrass album. Of all things, it's going to be a mixture of Rhubarb Red and Les Paul.
And I wanted to go back, back in the early 30s, what were you trying to do by designing your own electric instruments?
Well, the electric instrument at the beginning was a matter of some way of making it louder. And, of course, that's the same thing that we're doing to this at this moment, is making the instrument louder. But what was not considered and really developed was that you could make so many different sounds by where you place the pickup under the strings of the guitar and the way you design the pickup to pick up that sound, and to make something that is flexible enough to create all the sounds that you can possibly think of. And that became foremost in my mind, was that just because this is the sound I dream about, not necessarily is this the sound that Jeff Beck might be thinking of, or Jimmy Page, or any of the others. And so the whole idea was is to make the instrument as versatile as possible, so that you could create any of the songs that would, that is possible to be made. And of course, there is a limit. There is a limit to all sound.
And you were speaking of dreaming. What are you dreaming about now?
I can't answer that either. What's your next question?
I just keep putting my foot in my mouth.
That's okay.
But actually, from a guitar player, a friend of mine, John Schneider, he, one of the questions that he had for me to ask you was what you were dreaming about now.
Well, what I'm dreaming about now is a very complicated device. This device is a hearing aid. And the hearing aid has a lot to be desired. And you don't know the problems you have with a hearing aid until, unfortunately, I got hit in both ears at different times by different people in different locations and by accident. And so I've had 4 ear operations, and I've gone through a lot of hearing aid companies. And it's amazing to talk to these engineers that are very privy to what's going on and the problems that they're having, that they have a device called a hearing aid and not a true reproduction of what you hear. And, of course, it involves many, many, many problems. The first being is that people are very vain about wearing a hearing aid. They don't want it to be seen, and so Maggie, with your long hair, you can hide it in your earphones. You can, you can hide the hearing aids. The odd part about it is, people don't mind wearing a pair of glasses, but they do mind wearing a pair of earphones, hearing aids. The hearing aids are somehow associated with people that are, they're handicapped, and that handicap seems to go with older people wearing the hearing aids. The problem with the hearing aids, of the many problems that we have, the first one would be if we were all in a room, and you were talking to me, and everybody else is talking to everybody else. And this is just a party of people talking. It's very hard for a person with a pair of hearing aids to hear what you're saying and not hear what the other guy is saying. Okay? We don't want to hear the other person. We want to hear the person. So I've been working on that problem. Then you got to work with other problems that you pick up a Stradivarius and you expect to hear a Stradivarius, not a tin can. You expect to play a note and it's supposed to sound as beautiful as it did when you had your hearing. And if you had your hearing, like I had my hearing 100% at one time, and I could listen to something and it's imprinted in my mind as to what this guitar string sounds like.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the accident back in that almost took your life.
That was in Oklahoma. Mary and I tipped a car over, and in that accident, I just about checked out. And it was a battle, a long battle, 2 years and a lot of complications and things. And so the loss of the elbow and one arm and, oh, there was just so many things that happened, which is an interesting thing for your listeners, and that is that for every handicap, disability, tragedy that might happen, there's a good side to it. And I don't recommend them, but I'm saying in many cases, it probably has changed my life for the better. And so I have my heart surgery, and it gives me a chance to start over again, have my arthritis, and so I don't have, I have four fingers, I have five fingers, but the thumbs you don't count in this particular case. But with the fingers, if they're not mobile, if you can't flex them, and they're stiff, they're frozen, their arthritis is very bad, then the doctor says to you, well, one thing for sure, you're not going to play the guitar. He was thinking of, because he come down here last Monday and he enjoyed the show very much. And so it can be done if you have the determination and you have that drive to do it. You say it is possible to do it. And in many cases, in my case especially, the handicaps, the setbacks, have all been to an advantage. But I didn't think so at the time. I thought at the time it was a terrible thing to have happen. And it is a terrible thing to have happen, but there is some good that comes out of it. And it teaches your head, too. You know, you got a lot of things to think about. How lucky you are, and what's luck, and what's written in the book as to what's where are you going, where did you come from, you know, that kind of a thing.
I agree. And just recently I spoke with the great guitarist George Benson. George was doing a tribute concert in Los Angeles, I believe in March, so last month, a tribute to Nat King Cole. And as I was doing, you know, my research on you, you were brought in as a last-minute substitute for the
Oscar Moore.
Tell us about that experience working with Nat King Cole.
Norman Granz and Nat Cole came over in Hollywood to my backyard where I was recording, and they said, we have a problem. And I said, what's your problem? And so Nat Cole says, well, Oscar has found some chicken. He's locked up in an attic somewhere with his chicken. We're slipping pizzas under the door for him. And it seemed like we can't communicate with this guy. And we're short a guitar player. Do you think that you could fill in for him? And I says, well, I'm in the service, and you guys aren't, so I'll ask my commanding officer if I can take all the identification that I'm in the service, and did.